Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Camila Kadelska. In honor of a successful fund drive, we are showcasing our award-winning work. Every February, WPR submits stories from the past year for award consideration. We are still waiting to hear the results from 2024, so we wanted to share the stories that won awards from 2023. It was a big year for energy in the state, including a groundbreaking for a huge wind energy project outside of Rawlins.
They feel like it's replacing. Well, the coal's gone, and they've been closed. We need it all.
A forum tried to address stigmas that are stopping firearms owners from seeking mental health resources.
That they are maybe pushing people to a point to not get help, or pushing people to a point where they don't feel like they can get help.
Stay with us. This is Open Spaces.
Check out the Wyoming Public Radio Politics Quiz. Are you up to date on the latest state government news? If so, test that knowledge out. In this week's quiz, true or false, Wyoming's top elections board unanimously certified the results of the general election. Think you know the answer? Find out at wyomingpublicmedia.org and click the WPR Politics Quiz tab.
Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Camila Kadelska. Today, we are recognizing our award-winning newsroom by sharing some stories we received awards for in 2023. The Modern West Mending the Hoop season won both the Muro Award and the Public Media Journalists Association, or PMJA, award. The episodes are too long to play here, so we're sharing a story that host Melody Edwards put together for this show. Some cities have started reciting a list of original people from the area before a public event or meeting. This is a way that the American public is attempting to reckon with its history of genocide of Indigenous people. But what do Indigenous leaders and history keepers really think of these land acknowledgments? We decided to ask. Wyoming Public Radio's Modern West podcast series, Mending the Hoop, takes a look at the history of the Plains Indian Wars from the perspective of tribes. Modern West host and producer Melody Edwards assembled this collection of Indigenous voices.
Land acknowledgments are complicated.
You know, I think the value of land acknowledgments is the fact that they're just saying like, hey, you know what, this don't belong to us. You know, and I think that's a very powerful thing.
I think it's powerful because I think it says we understand the true history of this land. We understand that we are foreigners or immigrants to some sort. And I think that a land acknowledgement is an essence of honor. And I think that the more we're able to do that moving forward, the more people are going to tear down those false images of who we are. And maybe something will hit here in their heart to say, I want to learn more.
Land acknowledgments are great when you can acknowledge that the land used to belong to so many other ancestral tribes. It does show that people went beyond to look into that research. But that shouldn't be the stopping point. It should be the fact that we should all be doing something to accept and acknowledge Indigenous people back onto the land that they once belonged to.
A statement about acknowledging the Native Americans is great if it's sincere and if it's historically accurate.
I really think of it as just a first step. Like, it is not just something we should do to assuage guilt.
Especially too with universities. You know, when you hear a land acknowledgement, I'm like, that's great. And I'm like, but what are you doing for those tribes and those students that come from there? You know, for here in Wyoming, I would love for the Arapaho and the Shoshones and also the Crows and other people, the Utes, other people who have ties to this land to be able to be like, hey, you know what? You get free tuition. You know, that would be a powerful step. And you see that what's happening with Colorado, you know, where they're doing in-state tuition for all those tribes who identify in those areas. That's powerful.
Like, folks will open a meeting, you know, at a colonial institution with a land acknowledgement, but do nothing to support the Native or Indigenous students And that does not correspond.
There was this whole time of a rising land acknowledgement movement where it seemed like everybody and every entity and every organization was like, we need to have a land acknowledgement. And in many cases, as crazy as it sounds, for me anyway, it's crazy, is that they would ask Native people to do these land acknowledgements. And they would reach out and say, hey, I have this event. Would you be able to, do you know somebody, or would you be able to come and do a land acknowledgement? And to me, that was like such a light bulb moment that these organizations and people don't even realize what a land acknowledgement means or what it signifies or symbolizes. A Native person should not be doing that and should never be asked to do that, because we already acknowledge the land. We already know where we come from. We already, you know, we know. So it's really people that are not Native to acknowledge that these are lands that they work, play, and live, are lands that were stolen, and in some cases, Natives were forcefully removed.
There should also be an implied recognition that the land that you're on legally shouldn't be yours, okay? Almost universally, most of the treaties that were signed were broken by the United States. And so, you know, to sit there and say, oh, thanks for letting us steal all your land, it's disingenuous for one thing, but then it's just condescending and kind of that act of colonization and hegemony where we're saying, oh, you know, we still control you. We still dominate you. So therefore, you know, we have the freedom to say, gosh, thanks for what you've given us. We're not giving it back.
Right. I am of the opinion that we live in a capitalist society, and the best way to show support to something is to put your money where your mouth is. So I will frequently tell people to donate to Native organizations. Even if it's just a little bit, you know, if you're doing a land acknowledgement in front of 200 people and then everybody puts $2 towards an organization, that can turn into a sizable amount of money pretty fast. And so, I they're nice. I think it's time to put something else behind it besides the words.
So land acknowledgements are great, but there's so much more work that has to go beyond that to start showing and inviting people back into public lands, federal tribal lands, and say, you know what, this is yours. We still need your input to take care of it. We can't just do it ourselves, and we don't have the funding or the men to, you know, put boots on the ground to maintain it. I think incorporating tribes back into their ancestral land is that actual movement to acknowledge they were a part of the land.
That was former Northern Arapaho Chairman Jordan Dresser, Not Our Native Daughters founder Lynette Grable, Northern Arapaho member Yufna Soldier Wolf, Lakota historian Jeff Means, Standing Rock Sioux artist Danielle Seawalker, and Paiute artist Greg Deal. A story on invasive mud snails won a second place PMJA award in the climate and environmental feature category. You've probably been driving around the state in the summer and have seen those watercraft check stations by lakes and rivers. If you have a watercraft, you've got to stop. The reason why? Invasive aquatic species. This is part of Wyoming's effort to stop invasive species in our waters. And they've done a pretty good job. But one species has snuck its way in. As Wyoming Public Radio's Caitlin Tan reports, it was recently discovered in an Albany County lake in a really unique way.
So I'm going to go down to the shore's edge.
On a sunny October day, Jenny Loveridge walks in her swimsuit down to Allsop Lake. It's not much bigger than a pond in the middle of a prairie in Albany County. Loveridge is gearing up to snorkel. She gets her flippers wet and slips them on. The water is cold, 48 degrees. Loveridge lowers into the water. You can feel the coldness through her breathing. Loveridge is a scientist that's lived in Laramie since 2004. She's snorkeled just about every body of water within 200 miles.
Because I love the waters here. This is one of the reasons I live here, is to be able to enjoy the lakes and the reservoirs.
And this summer, when she was snorkeling in Allsop Lake, she saw something new on the plants.
Oh, they're everywhere. Just little black dots. I mean, they're tiny.
New Zealand mud snails, an invasive aquatic species. They're the size of a grain of rice with a swirly tan or dark colored shell.
I was just like, oh, this is, can't be good.
Like when you say everywhere, like thousands or?
Oh, millions.
So she called up the Game and Fish.
My name's Josh Leonard. I'm the Aquatic Invasive Species Coordinator for the Wyoming Game and Fish Department.
Leonard says mud snails do come from New Zealand, but were first found in the U.S. in Idaho's Snake River in the late 80s. A few years later, they were found in Wyoming.
Just like any invasive species, they outcompete those native species.
They can wreak havoc on fish by overtaking the habitat. So the native species that fish would normally eat start to decline. There can be 300,000 mud snails per square meter. And they're asexual, so it only takes one for them to multiply. And they also do this really weird and rare thing when fish eat them.
The opening of their shell, they can fully close that off. So they're able to basically survive the digestive tract of fish.
The fish use energy to eat them, but don't get any nutritional value. Leonard says prevention is key. Once they're in a body of water, it's hard to get rid of them. One of his main concerns is that they've possibly lived undiscovered in Alsop Lake for a couple of years.
Obviously, that means that there could have been a likelihood that they've been moved already to other waters.
So far, Game and Fish hasn't discovered them in other nearby lakes, but mud snails like to catch a free ride to the next body of water by latching onto things like snorkeling flippers, boats, or fishing waders, which Nicholas Gindelis uses when he fly fishes at Alsop Lake. He studies chemical engineering at the University of Wyoming.
I probably shouldn't be here fishing. I should be studying, but it's okay.
He comes out pretty regularly because, in theory, it's good trout fishing.
Well, it is if you're not me, I guess. I don't know if I'm not that great or what.
But Gindelis looks the part. He's got a scraggly beard, a ball cap that literally has a fish on it, and some long rubber waders. New Zealand mud snails weren't on his mind.
I had no idea that was a thing, if I'm being honest.
He says normally he just dries his waders, but doesn't clean them. And that's how invasive species can spread. Now that he knows...
Well, I guess I'll clean my waders so I don't spread it, because I'll probably be fishing the North Platte this weekend.
But he might be in the clear this time. Jenny Loveridge, the snorkeler, finishes her icy cold swim.
I think they might be hibernating because I didn't see any.
Really?
Yeah. Maybe they're in the bottom or something.
Which Game and Fish says is actually possible.
Ooh, that was cold.
Okay. When Loveridge gets home, she's going to bleach her flippers and goggles to clean them, just in case. Another way to clean your gear? Dry it for 10 days or freeze it overnight. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Caitlin Tan in Albany County.
As the demand for coal wanes, Carbon County sets its sights on a renewable energy project. That's up next on Open Spaces.
Wyoming Public Radio brings the news to you in our daily and weekly email newsletters. Sign up on our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome back to our special Open Spaces. Today, we're playing stories from 2023 that received regional and national awards. This next story, by our Energy and Natural Resources reporter, Caitlin Tan, won a first place regional Muro Award in the feature reporting category. Federal and local officials broke ground recently on a new power line project in Carbon County. It's supposed to transfer renewable energy to the rest of the West. This is just one way the Biden administration is hoping to achieve 100% clean energy by 2035. Wyoming Public Radio's Caitlin Tan reports this project is a stark difference to the energy history of the area.
One, two, three.
Just southeast of Rawlins on the Overland Trail Ranch, officials break ground with shovels on the Trans-West Express Powerline project. It'll be a 732-mile line that'll transfer Wyoming's wind-generated electricity to the southwest. U.S. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland speaks to a crowd gathered in the sagebrush desert. The wind ripped through 10 flags behind her, representing the interest groups, which included the Wyoming, Colorado, and California flags.
We know that clean energy transmission lines and renewable energy projects on public lands will help communities across the country to be part of the climate solution while creating good-paying jobs.
The project will start on this 320,000-acre private ranch where a wind farm that's in construction is also located. The line will transmit 3,000 megawatts of power generated from the wind and bring it all the way to southern Nevada. That's enough energy to power about a million homes located everywhere from Los Angeles, San Diego, Las Vegas, and Phoenix. Wyoming's Governor Mark Gordon is also in attendance.
It's wonderful to see so many people here today. What an exciting day.
Gordon is usually at odds with the Biden administration's push to move away from fossil fuels on public lands. A lawsuit dealing with this is actually still pending. But in regards to this wind project, Gordon is on the same page as the feds.
Because there's an urgency. As we see climate change, we know that we don't have time to waste. We have to move with diligence forward to make sure that we address the issue of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere with alacrity, with diligence, and with dedication.
This all comes as a stark difference from what Carbon County has known, which is oil, natural gas, and coal. U.S. Department of Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm acknowledges this.
We want people to say yes. Yes to clean energy, in the same way people have said yes to fossil energy.
And some people are saying yes, like Rollins Mayor Terry Wykum. He even has a little windmill pin on his shirt. He says the town has been in a bust recently as thousands of jobs were lost from the local coal mines closing and the oil fields slowing.
It is a lucky break for us to get this incredible thing in our midst. Some people don't like it. Some people don't like ice cream. I don't know what to tell you.
Wykum says people don't like it because
they feel like it's replacing. Well, the coal's gone and they've been closed. We need it all. You know, we need all the energy sources we can. It's not a competition.
The TransWest project will bring 1,000 temporary workers over the next decade. And by then, it'll be up and running. At a post-groundbreaking celebration at the local train depot, dozens of residents gather, eating cake, drinking champagne, and talking energy. Damian Sesko has lived in Rollins most of his life and runs a music academy. He's glad the project is coming to the area, but
one of the reasons we live here is the wide open spaces. You know, that's definitely had an effect on some of those things. Not everybody in the world necessarily wants to look at windmills.
Sesko is talking about that nearby wind farm that's currently under construction. If finished as planned, it'll be the largest wind farm in the country. Sesko says as a local business owner, he thinks both projects will bring a much-needed boost to the struggling economy in Rollins.
Obviously, it's going to be different, but change is always different. So you have to take what you can take and make the accommodations and just hope you don't go too far.
The TransWest Express Powerline project is 18 years in the making. The permitting process and changes in administrations took a lot of time. Officials pointed out future projects will need to be streamlined. Another 18 years, and it'll be well past the Biden administration's clean energy deadline of 2035. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Caitlin Tan in Carbon County.
WPR's own Hannah Haberman climbed the Grand Teton for a story that won her a first place Top of the Rockies award in the sport feature category. In 1923, Eleanor Davis became the first known woman to climb the Grand Teton, the second tallest peak in Wyoming. 100 years later, an all-female group of guides and climbers summited the peak to celebrate her legacy. Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman tagged along for the adventure.
On a sunny August morning, a group of 26 women of all ages walk up and down steep rock slabs in sticky rubber approach shoes. Below them are the sparkling blue waters of Jenny Lake, and above them are the jagged granite peaks of the Tetons.
As soon as I heard about this climb, I thought that sounds like something I should do. And I really do believe courage is like a muscle. And unless you push yourself to where you're uncomfortable, you don't get stronger.
That's Don Rucker, who lives in Jackson and is taking part in a 2-day training to learn the skills needed to navigate the Grand Teton. Tying knots, managing ropes, rock climbing, rappelling, and walking on steep terrain. Rucker is there with her friend Ellen Houlihan, who lives in North Carolina. The two went to West Point together and are now adventure partners.
Don has this motto that once a year we should do something that gets our hearts pumping a little hard and maybe scares us a little bit. So this is that adventure for this year.
Morgan McLaughlin is one of the guides teaching the training and is no stranger to breaking glass ceilings in the mountains. When she was 19, she became the youngest woman to ski the Grand Teton and says going into the mountains with a group of all women is something special.
It's very exciting and fun and powerful and important and sparkly and beautiful.
McLaughlin, who is now 28, helped organize the climb and was the youngest guide working at Exum Mountain Guides when she started in 2020.
I think it is really exciting and important that Exum is doing this climb as a way to help get and see more women out in the mountains, and it's also a really cool celebration of the centennial.
Kimberly Guile works at the Exum office and is often referred to as the guiding company's unofficial historian. She says Eleanor Davis's 1923 climb of the Grand was actually very early in the history of its known ascents.
So this was not only the first recorded female ascent, but only the third party to summit and only the fourth recorded ascent of the peak.
Davis was the physical education instructor at Colorado College and the vice president of the Colorado Mountain Club. Guile says that on the day Davis summited the Grand with her friend Albert, the six other men in their party turned around before the top.
The fact that Eleanor Davis was on this early climb of the Grand Teton is notable because climbing was a very male-dominated sport at that time, but obviously she was capable and more than able to hold her own.
100 years later, the group of all-female climbers and guides splits in half and heads into the mountains in two waves over the weekend. On the first day, the women hike more than 6 miles up a steep trail and gain almost 5,000 feet in elevation. They camp at the lower saddle below the Grand, where Exum guide Jessica Baker points out the path they'll take up the next day.
And then that's where you start into the famous belly crawl, belly roll, Owen Chimneys, and then up into the Sergeant Chimneys, and then scrambling the rest of the way to the summit.
The next morning, the group wakes up in the dark and starts hiking at 4:30 a.m. They navigate up steep slabs and rocky ramps. Then they rope up to tackle the so-called belly roll and crawl of the climb.
Juana, I'm gonna bump up ahead so that I'll like go belay you. So when the rope comes tight, you can say, "Help me, Warrior." And even if you can't hear me, which you might not be able to, yeah, go ahead and climb. Sound good?
Juana Johansson is waiting for her rope to go tight to start traversing on an exposed ledge with thousands of feet of open air below.
Juana, how are you feeling?
Good, how are you doing?
Good. Yes, how was the morning part?
Pretty great.
Yeah.
Johansson, who was born in the Philippines and now lives in Jackson, was able to come on the climb thanks to a scholarship from Exum, Women in the Tetons, and the Teton Climbers Coalition. She says her presence as a woman of color is helping to break down barriers.
This stuff is like rewriting narrative. But like we can rewrite the story and just be here, you know?
While not everyone chooses to go all the way to the top, a group reaches the summit just before 8 a.m.
So good, yay!
There's lots of laughing, hugging, and putting on glitter. A bed of fluffy clouds covers the valley below, and the blue sky feels enormous. Paige McLeod is one of the climbers on the summit. She's taking it all in.
This morning, I was not sure. How am I feeling now? Kind of in awe. In awe.
McLeod lives in Wilson and can't stop looking at the view.
It's a miraculous thing to be up here among all these awesome women and with glitter on their faces.
Johansson is also on the summit and gets her picture taken, standing tall with her arms out wide and a huge grin on her face.
I just finished crying,
There could be more tears.
But I feel super just grateful to be here. It's a magic place.
Amazing.
That's me, Morgan. Later.
Later.
Climbing.
Gotta go.
After about half an hour on the summit, the group starts descending back down to camp. Back at the lower saddle a few hours later, Johansson says the experience was deeply cathartic.
Honestly, I think I left a lot up there. I was allowed to leave some stuff up there I'd been carrying.
Johansson says she'll be taking home a feeling of being welcomed into the climbing community.
There was like kind of the dissolution of lines between like being separate and, you know, yeah, it feels very much like we all had to move as one being up this amazing being.
What will the next 100 years of climbing look like in the Tetons? For Johansson, she says she hopes the narrative can keep changing about who is climbing in the mountains. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Hannah Haberman.
Up next, a personal story about losing a home in a wildfire. Stay with us. This is Open Spaces.
A brand new season of the Modern West is coming your way. It's called The Gray in Between.
Am I crazy or is that a wolf?
Every time we opened a box, I could actually feel those people who they belong to.
It's all about the complexity of our Western lives.
It's sort of a slow-moving epidemic that is relentless.
Catch the trailer now under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome back to our award-winning Open Spaces special. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kadalska. Back in 2023, Wyoming Public Radio's podcast, The Modern West, produced a season called The Burn Scar. Episode 1 received a first-place award for podcasting from the top of the Rockies. But we will hear a preview for that season, since the episode is too long to play on this show. The Modern West podcast just released the trailer for their new series. The Burn Scar tells the story of Ariel Lavery, how her parents were evacuated, and how her family lost their home in the Marshall Fire. That's the urban wildfire that burned into the suburbs of Boulder, Colorado, in the middle of winter in 2021. The Modern West host, Melody Edwards, spoke with Lavery about why she decided to produce a podcast about this devastating event. Edwards starts by asking what made the Marshall Fire so unusual.
This fire was the very first time we had ever seen an urban fire, an urban wildfire in Colorado. Colorado had never seen anything like this before, and people who'd lived here for a long time were well acquainted with wildfire, I think, for a lot of people, sort of in concept only, or, you know, just from images that they saw through the media. And suddenly there was a wildfire that was burning through suburban neighborhoods in a very heavily populated area of the Front Range. So that was the first thing that made this fire so remarkable. And seeing those images on the television screens where I saw it from my hotel room in the middle of Kansas, I think was also just incredibly arresting. The media grabbed onto it right away, I think, because these images were so remarkable and disturbing to see. These were homes in an affluent area, you know, large homes, you know, people who had never imagined that they would be experiencing something like this.
In episode one, your parents are evacuating. And like you mentioned, you're in the hotel and kind of stuck there because of a freak ice storm. And I wonder if you can talk just a little bit about, you know, that combination and what that felt like to your family in that moment, because it does seem just like such a crazy coincidence.
Yeah. So I can't say, because I haven't looked at the science about that ice storm, if that was directly connected to human-caused climate change, the way that I discuss in the episode that the Marshall Fire was. But I can say that there was a realization the day after we all woke up and we sort of knew that my parents' house was gone. They were staying in a friend's basement in Boulder. We knew that they were now refugees. My husband and I had a conversation not long after that about the weather that was moving through where we were in Missouri, in Columbia, Missouri, that we should probably stay put because if we were to get on the road in that moment, we might be facing some severe weather that could put us at risk, at further risk. And so I was thinking, okay, my parents are staying in their friend's basement in Boulder. We are facing the choice of having to stay in this hotel room. And although we were safe, it definitely brought my mind to an imagining of the future and thinking, is this kind of what I need to prepare for, to be experiencing more and more? Is this what it's going to feel like to be a climate refugee? I know that people all over the world are going to have different experiences of climate change. But in this country, we're probably going to be seeing people having to live out of their cars, be more mobile, be more specific in their choices about where they live, not because it's a pretty area or because they like the people that are there, but they're going to have to be thinking about what the weather conditions and what the seasonal conditions are going to be there.
I think one of the parts of the series that affected me the most is when you talk about being homesick for a place that is gone. I wonder if you can just talk a little bit about that feeling and also how it relates to kind of the overall, the larger themes of the whole series.
Yeah. So the feeling that you're talking about is called solastalgia, and it was a term that was coined by Glenn Albrecht, who's an Australian philosopher. And he kind of came up with this term, you know, thinking a lot about a primary example of people in Appalachia, small communities in Appalachia, who witnessed their mountaintops destroyed for mining, you know, the strip mining that was going on there, which also provided their main source of income eventually. You know, those communities were sort of reorganized around the industry, but it doesn't mean that those people were any less sad or affected to see their environments destroyed that way. I had what I think is solastalgia. I mean, I haven't talked with Glenn Albrecht, so I don't know if it's okay to deem this experience solastalgia or not, but I had a feeling of that when I visited the site with my mom 4 months after the fire in April for the first time. I flew back out there because I wanted to help my parents, and I also just felt like I needed to see the site. I needed to see the neighborhood. As I say in the series, I'm one of those people who needs to see the dead body for it to be real. I noticed when I was on the site that the house finches were still there singing their song. Our neighborhood and the city of Louisville is in the flight path of DIA traffic, so we would always hear the jet planes roaring overhead. That was still there. It was a really strange feeling because I felt like I was in a place I'd never seen before. The smell, I'd never smelled anything like that. But then I suddenly recognized where I was because of the sounds. And that was a really strange feeling. And it wasn't until maybe a year later that I came across the term solastalgia. And I immediately was brought back to that moment and thinking, this is describing what that experience is. It's got to be. And I think it's an important term to understand because, and to start using in our common parlance, because probably more people are going to be experiencing things like this as the climate changes so quickly.
What are some of the hard decisions that your family has been forced to make as you've been recovering from losing your home in this fire?
So the first decision my parents had to make was where they were going to live. They had a pretty good coverage with their insurance, so they were able to get a payout without having to fill out an entire inventory. So they were able to start living on that payout. Their insurance also gave them living allowances, but they ended up retreating to and staying with friends in Boulder in their basement for the first couple nights. And then they relocated to another of my mom's friends. And my mom was thinking, well, maybe we can just stay at this person's house and we can pay her rent and just live here. Because I think when something like this happens, suddenly your whole world is upside down and you're questioning, should we even be living in this landscape? I mean, clearly it's not safe. So the question of where to live was the biggest decision they had to make initially. And my parents are elderly. My dad has Lewy body dementia, so my mom is his caretaker. She started going back and forth about whether or not they should move into senior living. There was an apartment that was available in a senior housing facility. She was really not keen on having to move in there. Eventually, they decided to move in because of my dad's condition, and mom thought it would probably be better for him to be in that community in a place where he would likely be safer and they would be taken care of in terms of meals and cleaning help and things like that. It wasn't until sometime later that my mom made the decision to rebuild.
I wonder, just to wrap up, if you could talk a little bit about just how you made this podcast. You started collecting the audio for it right away, as soon as the fire happened. Can you talk just a little bit about the process of making the podcast?
Sure. So I had actually been recording Zoom conversations with my parents for a while, because when my dad was first diagnosed with Lewy body dementia, I thought, I need to document. I just really like documenting things. So I was already recording Zoom audio. And then when this fire happened, you know, those recordings were happening. We had several that were scheduled regularly. And when I was out there in April, I brought my Zoom recorder with me there. Again, it was just this impulse of needing to record. I had no concept that I was going to be pitching this as a story idea to any podcast. I just needed to record this. I needed to somehow remember the feelings of, you know, visiting the site and being there. And it was on one of the days I was taking a shower in Colorado in April, after I had visited the site the first time, that I thought, I really should probably pitch this. And I immediately thought about you, and I thought about the Modern West. And the rest is history, I suppose. Once you know you're producing a series, then you just record everything you possibly can.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards speaking with podcast producer Ariel Lavery about their new Modern West series, The Burn Scar. When we come back, a look at how local businesses in Kemmer were prepping for an influx of nuclear workers. This is Open Spaces.
You already listen to public radio, but what if public radio could listen back? It does on the NPR One app. Hear local, national, and international news plus podcasts based on what you like. The more you listen, the more it gets to know you. Download NPR One at your app store.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. Today, we are sharing our award-winning stories from the most recent award season. That was 2 years ago. Another story from Caitlin Tan in the Energy Beat. This time she looked at the local businesses in Kemmer. It won first place from the top of the Rockies in business reporting. A first-of-its-kind nuclear facility is planned to be near Kemmer, a small boom-and-bust coal town. And over the next 7 years, there'll be a huge influx of workers. Wyoming Public Radio's Caitlin Tan reports on some local businesses that are prepping for the anticipated boom.
Hi. Are you Jessica?
I am.
Oh, so nice.
Real estate agent Jessica Lozier is sitting at the new coffee shop in town. Fossil Fuel Coffee Company. It's pretty empty. On the walls are fish fossils from the nearby desert. Kemmer is a small industry-driven town with a couple thousand people.
There's been times that it's been really busy, and there's been times that it's been not busy, and that downtown has kind of been dying.
And that's been the case for the past 5 years or so, mainly because both its coal mine and coal plant almost shut down. But in late 2021, there was a beacon of hope. The company TerraPower, founded by Microsoft billionaire Bill Gates, announced their plans to build a nuclear plant nearby.
It brought, I think, a revived, you know, sense of security for the community that it needed.
If everything goes to plan, about 1,600 temporary workers will come over the next 7 years to build the facility. And they're going to need short-term housing, like RV parks. Gordon Gunter is walking through patchy snow at his RV park just north of town.
I just turned the water on today.
Gunter and his family built this park in the 60s, and adding a few more spaces for guests has long been a goal.
See, here's the river right here. So you can sort of, these spaces start here and they run clear down the river. Well, I could actually do spaces all the way around the river.
Temporary energy workers are his main clientele. With the recent bust, he wasn't sure if expanding made sense. But once the nuclear project was announced, he started hearing from contractors.
So I got one of those calls last spring. I said, well, you know, how many sites do you think you'll need? And she said, oh, around 1,100. Well, we've got 44 max at this point. And I went, 1,100?
You heard that right. They need 1,056 more spaces than Gunter has to offer. But he is going to add 15 more over the next few years, which is a similar situation over at the Antler Motel across town.
He checked out of 8. Did his sister check out of 29? Because I was going to just show her that room with Joey, how he did all the stuff in there. Do you have a key for it on you or no?
Yeah.
Okay.
Seth Snyder manages the motel, and right now all 46 rooms are booked, mainly with temporary workers. Snyder is fixing up 9 more.
So many people come in and they're like, do you have a mini fridge in your room? And I'm like, of course. Like, we have a full-size freezer, which people do not get.
Something people might need if it's their home away from home. The 9 new rooms will be finished this year, but it's still a far cry from what's needed for the 1,600 temporary workers. And the city recognizes this. Brian Muir was brought on to help with Kemmer's transition. And while some old apartments in town might be renovated, Muir says not everyone will find housing in Kemmer.
It's probably going to still be a place where people will still commute here.
And for some in Kemmer, they don't mind that. They're excited about the security of the new industry, but they don't want it to become a big city either. TerraPower's Jeff Navin says for the next year, only about 100 workers will be there. The largest influx is still a few years off. And when that happens, Navin lightheartedly says,
might be a little more difficult to get a hotel room in Kemmer for the next few years than it was for the last few years.
But for now, Kemmer still feels quiet. Standing downtown, one sees the new coffee shop, but also a lot of empty storefronts. One person is out and about. The birds are chirping. A car drives by every few minutes or so. It's still small town Wyoming, even though it's been chosen for this first of its kind nuclear project. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Caitlin Tan in Kemmer.
A story I reported back in December of 2023 won a first place regional Muro Award in the feature reporting category. Take a listen. More than half of the firearm deaths in U.S. are done by suicide, and Wyoming has the highest amount of people who take their own life per capita in the country. But getting help for mental health problems is not easy for firearm owners. That's something Ashley Lubinsky found out when she came out publicly with her own struggles, and she's trying to change that.
Friend has, you know, helped a friend.
Ashley Lubinsky is sitting cross-legged on a wooden stage in a community center in Laramie. Long black hair covers her plaid blazer.
So my next question is for Devin, and then I promise I'll open it up. But I'm fascinated, so sorry you guys are getting my selfishness. I'm like, tell me more.
She's leading a town hall between two firearm owners who have been open about their own mental health struggles, Lubinsky is having them share what they've done with their handguns when hard times hit.
How to talk to somebody that wants to do it but is worried about the legal liability for it. Like, what would you say to them?
First, I would say, don't ignore it. Don't come.
This town hall is part of the first Firearms and Mental Health Conference held by the University of Wyoming's Firearms Research Center. Lubinsky is the executive director of the center, and this conference is part of her mission to get rid of the stigma gun owners feel about getting help.
If they're honest with their therapist or their psychiatrist that they are having suicidal ideation, and maybe even not that extreme, but they're just struggling with something, can that be misinterpreted in some respects as, you know, needing to have all their firearms taken away from them?
Lubinsky is a firearms historian. She spent her career trying to tell the social history of guns, the good, the bad, and the ugly. But as her career skyrocketed, she started noticing that something was not right with herself.
I noticed that there was just kind of this dichotomy to my personality, and it didn't always happen that way, but I did notice that as I kind of got busier and busier, that's when I would notice periodically I would kind of crash.
She started seeing a therapist, and it took a while, but she was eventually diagnosed with bipolar 2 disorder. She says that helped her handle it. But she started becoming acutely aware of society's perspective of gun owners with mental health problems. An advertisement for a gun organization made her want to take action.
And they were like, you know, you don't want a crazy person to get a gun. And then me having, you know, mental illness and trying to kind of reconcile with that and what that meant and how people can get help when that's the attitude so many people share.
So she decided to be honest with the world about her diagnosis. And she says she was shocked by the amount of private messages she got from people who felt afraid to get help, mainly because they think their firearms will be taken away.
First and foremost, what people need to understand is, as a clinician, I have no legal right to take anyone's firearms.
That's Cheryl D. Woody Fulland. She's a licensed clinical social worker based in Rollins. She says in Wyoming, clinicians can't take away guns, but that isn't necessarily true in other states. Many of her clients are ranchers and agricultural producers.
I've dealt with clients who have had suicidal ideation, who have firearms, usually on them because it's part of their work. Those are tools of their trade.
Fulland says she tries to explain to ranchers that getting help doesn't mean taking away a firearm, but rather working with someone to get them into a better place.
9 times out of 10, that person will calm down enough that we can have the conversation, because that's their fear of being locked up, the fear of losing whatever they have, the fear of not being able to get their firearms back.
Those discussions really come down to education, which is what Walk the Talk America is trying to do nationally. Michael Sedini is the founder.
People always assume that, you know, guns and mental health are mutually exclusive, and if you mix the two, then you get in trouble.
So his company is working on trying to get people to fight that stigma. He says gun manufacturers have long avoided it, but they're starting to get on board. Some are adding free and anonymous mental health screenings in the boxes of their guns.
Bought a gun, you should have a suicide prevention plan and a better mental health plan. You shouldn't be denied that. That should be something that you talk about in your gun ownership. That should start all the way from the get-go.
Education is what Lubinsky, the firearms historian, is trying to do. But she says the issue of firearms has just become too political and heated recently.
I don't think either community necessarily realizes that in their passion to defend what they believe in, that they are maybe pushing people to a point to not get help, or pushing people to a point where they don't feel like they can get help.
Lubinsky says as she tries to talk to both sides, she starts to feel bullied from both directions, and sometimes that's putting a strain on her mental health.
If we're trying to reduce firearms deaths across the board, we shouldn't push other people into feeling like they have no other place to go.
If you or someone you know is experiencing a mental health crisis, dial 988. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Kamila Kadalska. Thank you for listening to Open Spaces. The entire show and all the stories you heard here can be found on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. It can also be found wherever you get your podcasts, and we post all our stories on the station's social media platforms. Thanks to Ivy Engel, our digital producer today. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.